This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
British police clash with anti-establishment protesters and make at least a dozen arrests during the annual Million Mask March in London. Iran says its proposed resolution on nuclear disarmament serves as a benchmark for measuring the actions of UN member states against their claims. Also ahead, Hamas condemns as a war crime the killing of a Palestinian teenager by Israeli forces during Friday's anti-settlement protests in the occupied West Bank. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, an anti-establishment demonstration has turned violent in the British capital with police clashing with protesters in central London. At least 8 officers were injured during scuffles in the Parliament Square. The Metropolitan Police said 12 people were arrested. Demonstrators wearing masks had gathered at the nearby Trafalgar Square, with some throwing Molotov cocktails at the officers. They also burnt an effigy of Prime Minister Boris Johnson in a show of anger at his policies. November the 5th marks an annual Million Mask March, which draws massive rallies against government's overreach, income inequality, and more recently, COVID-19 restrictions.
Hundreds of anti-establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They have a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these cenotaphs and everything, yeah, we care about the people of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. but instead at the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group don masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
Well, as you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners. You have a war on the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, the criminality. We're not, if anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. They need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.
The mostly peaceful Million Mask March started in 2003 and has grown bigger in number. A grassroots group that says it aims to shed light on government corruption and protect liberty. Saeed Purza, London.
Elsewhere, Iran says its proposed resolution on nuclear disarmament serves as a benchmark for measuring the actions of UN members against their claims. In a statement, Iran's ambassador to the UN said any negative vote by Western countries to Iran's proposal would expose their hypocrisy. Majid Takht Ravanchi said the West has always turned a blind eye to Israel's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction and instead pointed fingers at Iran over nuclear proliferation. Takht Ravanchi underscored Iran's policy that WMDs, including nuclear arms, undermine global security, and the safe and secure world requires the annihilation of such weapons. The UN General Assembly First Committee approved Iran's draft resolution last week. The Assembly is expected to vote for its final adoption in about a month. Political commentator Lawrence Davidson says Israel is not only an obstacle to nuclear disarmament, but a threat to global security.
The United States will dismiss it as a ploy. They will say that Iran is trying to get nuclear weapons and at the same time trying to promote non-proliferation, and that's a contradiction. I'm pretty sure that's going to be their reaction. And of course, what the West will do, at least the United States, will try to change the subject or redirect the target of the effort to expose their own hypocrisy. See, so I think it's a good resolution. I think we need to be reminded repeatedly of this predicament with nuclear weapons and the fact that Israel, in so many ways, stands as an obstacle to progress, not only with nuclear weapons, and also but with international law generally.
Israeli forces have once again used the lethal force against Palestinian demonstrators in the occupied West Bank, killing a teenager. Regime forces fatally shot a 13-year-old Mohammed Dadas during demonstrations in Deir al-Hatab village east of Nablus. Demonstrators had gathered there to voice anger at Israel's illegal settlement construction. Regime forces also attacked similar protests in the town of Beita south of Nablus and elsewhere, injuring dozens. The killing of the Palestinian teenager drew strong reaction from the resistance movement Hamas.
This blood shall be the fuel for our people's revolution, which will not rest until it achieves its goals.
The movement condemned the killing as a war crime. Meanwhile, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya called on the international community and the rights group organizations to end Israel's ongoing violation of human rights. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also criticized the international community and the United Nations for their silence on the incident and other Israeli crimes. It urged the International Criminal Court to investigate the regime's atrocities. Israel frequently uses lethal force against Palestinians who do not pose an immediate threat to its forces or its settlers. Our correspondent in occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil, has given us more details about the West Bank protests, during which one Palestinian was killed and scores were also injured.
Well, Palestinians have nothing but to keep urging the international community to act, to move, not to only condemn and slam the Israeli practices and policies and the Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. Palestinians are fed up from these statements. They say that if the international community wants really to move, they can do it. They can impose sanctions on the Israeli regime because otherwise the Israeli regime would continue to carry out the crimes and the aggression against the people of Palestine, especially here in the occupied West Bank. So Palestinians are still hoping that the European Union and the international community could move and impose sanctions on the Israeli regime.
Moving on, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has condemned the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia as a show of Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering. A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says the deal contradicts U.S. President Joe Biden's stated commitment to peace in Yemen. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi says the arms sale proves that the Biden administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. The Pentagon announced the sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia on Thursday. The $650 million deal is the first major military sale to Riyadh since Biden took office. U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia have sparked global condemnation, given the kingdom's devastating war that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, most of them civilians. Sarah Flanders is the co-director of International Action Center. She believes the U.S. weapons sale to Saudi Arabia contradicts Joe Biden's campaign promises and serves no one but the arms manufacturing companies.
Well, this is just the latest U.S. breaking of commitments. Certainly, President Biden did again and again commit during the election campaign. He called Saudi Arabia a pariah state and said that all weapons sales would be ended. And of course, that's not what's happened. And this is not even the first. In September, there was a $500 million helicopter parts and maintenance contract that was signed. So this, along with the $650 million on air-to-air missiles, it's over $1 billion in U.S. direct supplies to Saudi Arabia. All the talk about leading with diplomacy and ending the war on Yemen, these are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapons sales, which benefit Raytheon and benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
Turning to Iraq now, where one person has been killed in clashes between security forces and demonstrators protesting the results of last month's parliamentary election in Baghdad. Over 120 people were also injured in the scuffles. The violence broke out when protesters marched on the heavily fortified Green Zone, denouncing the election as a fraud. In a statement, the leader of the Asaib Ahl al-Haq resistance party condemned the attack on protesters, calling for those responsible to be held accountable. Faisal Khazali also called on protesters to exercise restraint. Iraqis have been holding rallies across the country against the outcome of the October 10 vote. The initial tally put the bloc of influential cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in the lead. Protesters, however, say numerous violations were recorded during the voting and counting processes. Elsewhere, the trial of three white men charged with last year's killing of a young black man has begun in the U.S. state of Georgia. The prosecutor says the defendants had killed Ahmed Arbery only based on assumptions.
But in this case, all three of these defendants did everything they did based on assumptions. Not on facts, not on evidence, on assumptions. And they made decisions in their driveways based on those assumptions that took a young man's life.
During the trial on Friday, the defendants pleaded not guilty, saying they thought Arbery might have been fleeing a crime. According to court accounts, the defendants had chased and cornered the 25-year-old victim with their pickup trucks while he was jogging in a mostly white neighborhood in February 2020. One of the defendants then fatally shot him with a shotgun. Arbery's case is one of the many recent racially motivated ones in the U.S. that has fueled nationwide protests. The trial of the accused has also been controversial for its seemingly disproportionate jury, which includes 11 white people and only one black man. South Korea's opposition Conservative People Power Party has nominated former prosecutor Yoon Suk-yeol to run for president in March 2022. The ruling Democratic Party in October chose former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung, with the two staking out very different policies in what will likely become a divisive and close contest. Our correspondent Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Former prosecutor, anti-corruption maverick, and political novice Yoon Suk-yeol Friday won the nomination to run for president of South Korea for the Conservative People Power Party.
The South Korean people, who want to restore fairness and common sense in our society, have chosen me, a political novice. Instead of happiness, I feel a sense of responsibility and duty to achieve a change of government.
Former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung won the Democratic Party nomination October 10th and proposes a universal basic income among several liberal policies.
Rooting out unfairness, inequality, and corruption, and making a wealthy country where workers are respected are the clear and stern commands from the public.
Early polling shows the candidates running neck and neck.
I support Yoon Suk-yeol because I think that the government of this country ridiculing people should be replaced as soon as possible because lies after lies continue.
I support Lee Jae-myung because he has gone through very difficult times and overcome everything by himself to get where he is now. And he is open and above board as well as firm.
The two main candidates for president of South Korea, Conservative Yoon Suk-yeol and Democrat Lee Jae-myung, clash on a number of issues, including North Korea policy. Lee favors peace-building engagement with Pyongyang, whereas Yoon advocates strengthening the alliance with the United States through regular military exercises. South Korea's presidential election is slated for March 9th next year, with the winner set to serve a single five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Journalists in India have been grappling with a growing spate of violence over the last few years. The fraternity hangs in the balance, with many questioning if the truth is meaningful in Modi's new India. Wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on surviving. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
The cause and consequences of America's 21st century wars have by now been well documented. A staggering $8 trillion in expenditures and more than 380,000 civilian deaths, as calculated by Brown University's Cost of War project. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by William D. Harting, writer. This article is published under the heading Corporate America Cashed In on Post-9/11 Pentagon Spending Surge. Stay tuned for the details, please. The cause and consequences of America's 21st century wars
have by now been well documented. A staggering $8 trillion in expenditures and more than 380,000 civilian deaths as calculated by Brown University's Cost of War project. The question of who has benefited most from such military spending, unfortunately, has received far less attention. Corporations large and small have left the financial fist of that post 9/11 surge in military spending with genuinely staggering sums in hand. After all, Pentagon spending has totaled an almost unimaginable $14 trillion plus since the start of the Afghan war in 2001, up to one half of which, catch a breath here, went directly to defense contractors. The political climate created by the global so-called War on Terror, or GWT, as Bush administration officials quickly dubbed it, set the stage for homogeneous increases in the Pentagon budget. In the first year after the 9/11 attacks and the invasion of Afghanistan, defense spending rose by more than 10%, and that was just the beginning. It would, in fact, increase annually for the next decade, which was unprecedented in the American history. The Pentagon budget peaked in 2010 at the highest level since the Second World War, over $800 million, substantially more than the country spent on its forces at the height of the Korean or Vietnam Wars during President Ronald Reagan's rounded military buildup of 1980s. And in the new political climate sparked by the reaction to the 9/11 attacks, those increases reached well beyond expenditures specifically tied to fighting and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As Harry Stone Cipher, then vice president of Boeing, told the Wall Street Journal in an October 2001 interview, "The purse is now open. Any member of Congress who doesn't vote for the funds we need to defend this country will be looking for a new job after next November." Stone Cipher's prophecy of rapidly rising Pentagon budget proved correct, and it's never ended. The Biden administration is anything but an exception. Its latest proposal for spending on the Pentagon and related defense work like nuclear warhead development at the Department of Energy topped $753 billion for FY 2022. Not to be outdone, the House and Senate Armed Services Committees have already voted to add roughly $24 billion to that staggering sum. And who benefited? The benefits of the post 9/11 surge in Pentagon spending have been distributed in a highly concentrated fashion. More than one-third of all contracts now go to just five major weapons companies, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. Those five received more than $166 billion in such contracts in fiscal year 2020 alone. To put such a figure in perspective, the $75 billion in Pentagon contracts awarded to Lockheed Martin that year was significantly more than 1.5 times the entire 2020 budget for the State Department and the Agency for International Development, which together totaled $44 billion. While it's true that the biggest financial beneficiaries of the post 9/11 military spending surge were those five weapons contractors, they were anything but the only ones to cash in. Companies benefiting from the buildup of the past 20 years also included logistics and construction firms like Kellogg, Brown & Root, KBR, and Becho, as well as armed private security contractors like Blackwater and DynCorp. The Congressional Research Service estimates that in FY 2020, the spending for contractors of all kinds had grown to $420 billion, or well, half of the total Pentagon budget. Companies in all three categories noted above took advantage of wartime conditions in which both the speed of delivery and less rigorous oversight came to be considered the norms. To overcharge the government or even engage in outright fraud. The best known reconstruction and logistics contractor in Iraq and Afghanistan was Halliburton, through its KBR subsidiary. At the start of both the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, Halliburton was the recipient of the Pentagon's logistics civil augmentation program contracts. Those open-ended arrangements involved coordinating support functions for troops in the field, including setting up military bases, maintaining equipment, and providing food and laundry services. By 2008, the company had received more than $30 billion for such work. Halliburton's role would prove controversial indeed, reeking as it did of self-dealing and blatant corruption. The notion of privatizing military support services was first initiated in early 1990s by Dick Cheney, which he was Secretary of Defense in the George H.W. Bush administration, and Halliburton got the contract to figure out how to do it. We suspect you won't be surprised to learn that Cheney then went on to serve as the CEO of Halliburton until he became vice president under George W. Bush in 2001. His journey was, if not the classic case of that revolving door between the Pentagon and the defense industry, now used by so many government officials and generals or admirals, with all the obvious conflicts of interest it entails. Once it secured its billions for work in Iraq, Halliburton proceeded to vastly overcharge the Pentagon for basic services, even while doing shoddy work that put U.S. troops at risk. And it would prove to be anything but alone in such activities. Starting in 2004, a year into the Iraq War, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, a controversially congressionally mandated body designed to root out waste, fraud, and abuse, along with congressional watchdogs like Representative Henry Waxman, exposed scores of examples of overcharging, faulty construction, and outright theft by contractors engaged in the rebuilding of that country. Again, you undoubtedly won't be surprised to find out that relatively few companies suffered significant financial or criminal consequences for what can only be described as striking war profiteering. The Congressional Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan estimated that as of 2011, waste, fraud, and abuse in two war zones had already totaled $31 billion to $60 billion. A case in point was the International Oil Trading Company, which received contracts worth $2.7 billion from the Pentagon's Defense Logistics Agency to provide fuel for U.S. operations in Iraq. An investigation by Congressman Waxman, chair of the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee, found that the firm had routinely overcharged the Pentagon for the fuel it shipped into Iraq, making more $200 million in profits on oil sales of $1.4 billion during the period from 2004 to 2008. More than a third of those funds went to its owner, Harry Sargent III, who also served as the finance chairman of the Florida Republican Party, and Waxman summarized the situation in this way. The documents show that Mr. Sargent's company took advantage of U.S. taxpayers. His company had the only license to transport fuel through Jordan, so he could get away with charging exorbitant prices. He never seen such a situation. A particularly egregious case of shoddy work with tragic human consequences involved the electrocution of at least 18 military personnel at several bases in Iraq from 24 on. This happened thanks to faulty electrical installations, some done by KBR and its subcontractors. An investigation by the Pentagon's Inspector General found that commanders in the field had failed to ensure that renovations had been properly done. The Army did not set standards for jobs or contractors, and KBR did not ground electrical equipment it installed at the facility. The Afghan reconstruction process was similarly replete with examples of fraud, waste, and abuse. These included a U.S.-appointed economic task force that spent $43 million constructing a gas station essentially in the middle of nowhere that would never be used, another $150 million on lavish living quarters for U.S. economic advisors, and $3 million for Afghan police patrol boats that would prove similarly useless. Perhaps most disturbingly, a congressional investigation found that a significant portion of $2 billion worth of transportation contracts issued to U.S. and Afghan firms ended up as kickbacks to warlords and police officials or as payments to the Taliban to allow large convoys of trucks to pass through areas they controlled, sometimes as much as $1,500 per truck or up to $500,000 for each 300-truck convoy. In 2009, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton stated that one of the major sources of funding for the Taliban is the protection money paid from just such transportation contracts. A second stream of revenue for corporations tied to those wars went to private security contractors, some of which guarded U.S. facilities or critical infrastructure like Iraqi oil pipelines. The most notorious of them all was, of course, Blackwater, a number of whose employees were involved in a 2007 massacre of 17 Iraqis in Baghdad's Nisour Square. They opened fire on civilians at a crowded intersection while guarding a U.S. embassy convoy. The attack prompted ongoing legal and civil cases that continued into the Trump era, when several perpetrators of the massacre were pardoned by the president. In the wake of those killings, Blackwater was rebranded several times, first as XE Services and then as Academy, before eventually merging with the Triple Canopy, another private contracting firm. Blackwater founder Eric Prince then separated from the company, but he has since recruited private mercenaries on behalf of the United Arab Emirates for deployment to the civil war in Libya in violation of a United Nations arms embargo. Prince also unsuccessfully proposed to the Trump administration that he recruit a force of private contractors meant to be the backbone of the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan. Another task taken up by private firms Titan and CACI International was the interrogation of Iraqi prisoners. Both companies had interrogators and translators on the ground about Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, a site where such prisons were brutally tortured. The number of personnel deployed and the revenues received by security and reconstruction contractors grew dramatically as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan wore on. The Congressional Research Service estimated that by March 2011, there were more contractor employees in Iraq and Afghanistan, that is about 155,000, than American uniform military personnel, that is 145,000. In its August 2011 final report, the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan put the figure even higher, stating that contractors represent more than half of the U.S. presence in the contingency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and at times employing more than a quarter million people. While an armed contractor who had served in the Marines could earn as much as $200,000 annually in Iraq, about three-quarters of the contractor workforce there was made up of people from countries like Nepal or the Philippines or Iraqi citizens. Poorly paid, at times they received as little as $3,000 per year. A 2017 analysis by the Cost of War Project documented abysmal labor conditions and major human rights abuses inflicted on foreign nationals working on the U.S.-funded projects in Afghanistan, including false imprisonment, theft of wages, and death and injuries in areas of conflict. With the U.S. military in Iraq reduced to a relatively modest number of armed advisors and no American forces left in Afghanistan, such contractors are now seeking foreign clients. For example, a U.S. firm, Tire One Group, which was founded by a former employee of Blackwater, trained four of the Saudi operatives involved in the murder of Saudi journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi, an effort funded by the Saudi regime. As the New York Times noted when it broke that story, such issues are likely to continue as American private military contractors increasingly look to foreign clients to shore up their business as the United States scales back overseas deployments after two decades of war. Adding one more factor to the two-decade so-called war on terror, explosion of corporate profits. Overseas arms sales also rose sharply in this era. The biggest and most controversial market for U.S. weaponry in recent years has been the West Asia-North Africa region, particularly sales to countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE regimes, which have been involved in a devastating war in Yemen, as well as fueling conflicts elsewhere in the region. Donald Trump made the most noise about the West Asia arms sales and their benefits to U.S. economy. However, the giant weapons-producing corporations actually sold more weaponry to Saudi Arabia on average during the Obama administration, including three major offers in 2010 that totaled more than $60 billion for combat aircraft, attack helicopters, armored vehicles, bombs, missiles, and guns, virtually an entire arsenal. Many of those systems were used by the Saudis in their intervention in Yemen, which has now involved the killing of thousands of civilians in indiscriminate airstrikes and the imposition of a blockade that contributed substantially to the death of nearly a quarter of a million people to date. Reining in the excess profits of weapons contractors and preventing waste, fraud, and abuse by private firms involved in supporting U.S. military operations will ultimately require reduced spending on war and our preparations for war. So far, unfortunately, Pentagon budgets only continue to rise and yet more money flows to the big five weapons firms. To alter this remarkably unvarying pattern, a new strategy is needed, one that increases the role of American diplomacy while focusing on emerging and persistent non-military security challenges. National security needs to be redefined, not in terms of a new Cold War with China, but to forefront crucial issues like pandemics and climate change. It's time to put a halt to the direct and indirect foreign military intervention the United States regime has carried out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and so many other places in this century. Otherwise, we are in for decades of more war, profiteering by weapons contractors reaping massive profits with impunity.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Washington's own terrorists.
This is Miami, an international metropolis known for its beaches, tourism. Miami is also the capital of the Cuban exile community. And Spanish is more common than English as the trading language. The Cuban exiles have historically juxtaposed Miami's capitalist bonanza to the financial hardships of communist Cuba, located only 90 miles away. But not many will associate present-day Miami to the biggest terrorist center in the whole world, which is how this city was described during the 1960s. Up to the present day, these Miami-based Cuban exiles still seem to get their way with the U.S. government, no matter what they do.
The United States likes to protect its own, Washington's own terrorists.
In 1961, a paramilitary group of Cuban exiles, funded and trained by the CIA, set off from Florida with the aim of invading Cuba and toppling the socialist government. After disembarking at the Bay of Pigs, they were defeated by the Cuban forces under the command of Fidel Castro, The survivors of this failed invasion returned to the U.S., where many of them regrouped into different armed militias, all of them based around Miami. One such group that has been active for almost 5 decades is Alpha 66, and veteran fighters Ociel Gonzalez and Reynold Rodriguez are two of its founders. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., a lawyer specialized in human rights has been coming at odds with most of his fellow Cuban Americans and the U.S. establishment. For years, Jose Portierra has been fighting against the U.S. government's tolerance of fringe groups, such as Alpha 66.
These folks train openly in southern Florida in the Everglades. They dress up like Rambo in their camouflage. They crawl around in the swamps before television cameras to show how they're training to defeat the government of Raul Castro and how they were planning to blow up installations in Cuba.
There's a law called the Neutrality Act that prohibits people from using United States shores, United States territory, to train or carry out acts of sabotage and subversion against other countries. It's a law that was passed by Congress because the business of making war is the business of government, not a fringe group.
After years of transmitting from a van with heavily armed guards as lookouts, the U.S. authorities eventually arrested a member of Alpha 66 for illegal radio broadcasts, but very quickly let him go and returned their van, although without the radio transmitter. Many of the weapons that have been seized from Alpha 66 are cataloged as combat weapons, intended exclusively for military use.
Sometimes the acts of terrorism are so blatant, they have to do something. Otherwise, the American people won't understand why you're protecting these guys. But what happens is you don't prosecute them zealously, or you make sure that he doesn't get a lot of time.
Santiago Alvarez, a millionaire Miami-based property developer, is another member of Alpha 66. The FBI also found a silencer and a grenade launcher. Instead of charging him with providing material support to terrorist activities, a crime which carries a sentence of 15 years to life, Santiago Alvarez only had to plead guilty to one count of illegal weapons possession. Raul Alzaga migrated to the United States from Cuba when he was only 6 years old. After radically changing his posture towards Cuba and relocating to Puerto Rico, he teamed up with his old friend Carlos Muñiz, and together they started Viajes Varadero, a tourist agency that promoted what up to then had been banned by law, the travel of Cuban exiles back to the island. Alpha 66 and its associates were to, once again, play an active role in Raul's life. The murder of Carlos Muñiz was orchestrated and carried out by a group of Cuban right-wing extremists based in Puerto Rico, one of which is widely suspected to be Julito Labatut, seen here on a TV interview from 2001. Another high-profile extremist is suspected to have engineered the murder together with Labatut. Reynold Rodriguez is regarded as the strongman amongst the veteran anti-Castro fighters based in Miami. According to him, the accusations of murder that Raul and others make against him come from a certain threat he publicly made after being himself the victim of an attack. Back in Puerto Rico, the attack on the travel industry wasn't to cease with the murder of Muñiz. Also based in Miami, Antonio Veciana is another founding member of Alpha 66. He shares more than just a friendship with Reynold Rodriguez. The likely reasons for the attempt on Antonio Veciana's life are the many plots to murder Fidel Castro which he directed. Just as all the other members of Alpha 66 we have seen so far, Antonio Veciana also used to be on the payroll of the CIA. After fleeing Cuba following his first attempt on Castro's life, Antonio Veciana continued working for the CIA in South America. Eventually, in 1971, he heard of Castro's planned visit to Chile, and with the help of his CIA binders, plotted another attempt on his archenemy. Back in Santiago Alvarez's luxury Miami mansion, he and his fellow Alpha 66 comrades in arms are reminiscing of the old times. Together, they used to steal weapons from the U.S. Army and use them to carry out commando attacks on the Cuban shoreline. The MRR was a subversive group financed and armed by the CIA. It operated from Central America, carrying out bombings, arson attacks, and acts of sabotage against Cuba. However, according to the Cuban government, these were not Alvarez's only civilian casualties. Cuban authorities allege that Alvarez was on board a motorboat that shelled the shoreline of a Cuban fishing village in 1971, killing two men and wounding four others, including two young girls. Santiago and his friends feel in a celebratory mood as Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's president and the man whom they see as Fidel Castro's greatest friend, has just passed away. Meanwhile, in the other side of town, Cuban journalist Max Lesnik and a group of his friends watch with sadness the funeral of Venezuela's commander-in-chief. Max has lived in Miami since fleeing Cuba in 1961. He was opposed to communism in Cuba, but has also voiced praise for Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez caring for the impoverished classes.
Viva Chavez!
Through a Varieties magazine he used to have during the 1970s, Max condemned the violent acts of the anti-Castro extreme right. Max's unwavering stance against terrorism was manifested more firmly when, in 1976, a Cuban commercial airline was blown into pieces, killing all passengers on board. For decades, the coasts of Florida have been a safe haven for CIA-trained terrorists capable of the most barbaric acts. These acts of terror not only took place in foreign lands, but also on U.S. soil. Behind the wave of terror were the anti-Castro extremists, and, above all of them, was one man in particular. Lawyer José Pertierra has incessantly fought to bring Luis Posada to justice for masterminding the bombing of the Cuban airliner. José Pertierra believes the amount of evidence against Luis Posada is overwhelming.
We have confessions by his co-conspirators, Hernán Ricardo Trevilugo, who finger Posada Carriles.
Hernán Ricardo and Freddy Lugo are two Venezuelan mercenaries who were the actual perpetrators of the crime.
The phone calls that were made by Hernán Ricardo to Caracas, to Posada Carriles' office, looking for Posada Carriles and to Orlando Bosch moments after the downing of the plane.
Lugo and Ricardo confessed to being hired by Coru, which they accurately describe as the anti-Castro group headed by Luis Posada and Orlando Bosch, another former employee of the CIA. Soon after the attack, Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, was quick to deny any U.S. involvement in the bombings.
The United States had absolutely nothing to do with any of its organs in the explosion of the Cuban airliner.
Kissinger then went a bit further and stated that no one in contact with the American government has had anything to do with the bombing. However, 20 years after the downing of the Cubana airliner, new evidence related to this incident was to surface.
Declassified documents of the United States government, where there is an admission by Posada Carriles days before the downing of the plane that he had the intention to blow up a plane and that Orlando Bosch had all the details.
Contrary to what Henry Kissinger had declared, the CIA had known about the plans to bomb the plane as far as 3 months before the incident. The agency had sent a memo with the subject possible plans of Cuban exile extremists to blow up a Cubana airliner to top officials at the White House, the FBI, and the Pentagon. Just over 3 months after the CIA's memo regarding the imminent terrorist attack, ex-CIA agent Luis Posada orchestrated the bombing of Cubana Flight 455. Although for more practical reasons, Luis Posada's former associate also condemns the barbarity of the airliner bombing. Antonio Veciana's comrades from Alpha 66 still deny Posada's involvement in the bombing. However, after many years of discreet silence, Antonio Veciana now told us some details never before disclosed, revealing even more evidence of Posada's guilt. After Venezuelan bombers Ricardo and Lugo confessed to the crime, they implicated Luis Posada and Orlando Bosch. The four of them were jailed in Venezuela, from where they had planned the attack. While Orlando Bosch was being interrogated in Caracas, back in the United States, Antonio Veciana was summoned by the U.S. Congress. As Veciana was to discover, the concerns from the U.S. Congress were rather more related to financial issues than to the loss of human lives. Despite his obvious involvement in the bombing, in 1987, a pro-American Venezuelan government set Orlando Bosch free. 2 years earlier, Luis Posada had already managed to escape from